hope you're enjoying your visit to the planetarium and to the aquarium and enjoying all the where we're another world there. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable on this Wednesday, the 20th of May. It is 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, freshly, and we welcome you to the program. If you would like to be a part, to be an active participant in our little democracy here, we would love for you to do so. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. We would love to hear from you. We're going to be talking about all kinds of good stuff, and we certainly are interested in what you have to say about these items. Let me introduce our panel to you, and then we will get started. WAMC's Alan Shartok, good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm upbeat. I'm excited. I'm ready to roll. And I got to tell you, I was out doing my 4 miles this morning at 5:30 in the morning, and there were a lot of people out there. Wow, it was coldish, but it's going to get warm today.
It's going to be a beautiful day. It's supposed to be a beautiful week, and people are out and ready. And in some cases, that's okay. In other cases, maybe not. But we're transitioning.
Did I hear another voice in the studio with you?
No.
Oh.
No other voice in the studio.
That was, maybe I'm just hearing voices.
No,
won't be the first time.
we do have other voices on the various connections here. We have Bob Griffin with us. He is Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, everybody. I just want to wish everybody a happy National Quiche Lorraine Day and just ask people to celebrate responsibly.
Wow. That's a lot of cheese, right?
Yeah, a lot of cheese, a lot of eggs. Maybe a little ham.
Yeah. Bob, I have a question for you. Now that you know you have this incredible title as the head of this preparedness operation, are you getting calls from all over the world about how to prepare?
Yes, we are. We've been really busy, and along with our School of Public Health, we've been taking a lead in as both subject matter experts and working with the state officials. So it's been a great relationship, and it's certainly what the vision for this school was when it was created by the governor in 2015. So
smart
our faculty have been in great demand.
So. How many times a day do you find yourself saying, you know, we have no idea?
Well, typically that's about every 15 minutes. But that's normally. That's not even a pandemic.
Oh, okay. So. Not even a pandemic. All right. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's an old saying that to be an expert, you have to be from more than 50 miles away.
So you have a briefcase.
Oh, yeah, there's that.
Terry Gibson is with us. Very nice to have him back. SUNY New Paltz communications professor and former New York State senator. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
Good morning. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. Very nice to have you on the program. Also, last certainly not least, investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
Good morning. This high energy is driving me back towards my bedroom, I have to say.
Oh, we'll turn you, I promise. You'll be with us in just a moment. Lots of optimism, charm, sunshine, light. You're ready,
Oh,
Rosemary.
Yeah, that's my role, right.
You play
have
it
so well. Have some
quiche. Yeah, have some
quiche. We are
quiche.
Not doomed.
Have some quiche. All right, let us talk about what's going on in the world. We will begin with the president expressing some... opposition? How about that? To extending unemployment benefits enacted in response to the pandemic. President Trump on Tuesday privately expressed opposition to extending a weekly $600 boost in unemployment insurance for laid-off workers affected by the coronavirus pandemic, according to three officials familiar with his remarks during a closed-door lunch with Republican senators on Capitol Hill. The increased unemployment benefits paid by the federal government but administered through individual states were enacted this year as part of a broader $2 trillion relief package passed by Congress. The boost expires this summer, and House Democrats have proposed extending the aid through January of 2021. But congressional Republicans have said they are concerned that some workers are making more money on unemployment insurance than if they were on a payroll, and therefore have less incentive to return to work or find a new job. Alan.
Well, it ought to be done. You know, We do know that unemployment and other things got really messed up in New York State and in other places. And the governor proudly announced yesterday, and his people announced, that they were all caught up, that everybody was getting everything that they should be getting now. I suppose there'll be some people who think, you know, they're not. But obviously, this is a balancing act. You have to balance. I have heard, I don't want to be like the president, but I have heard from people that, you know, there's a real issue here, getting people back to work. And maybe there is some truth to that, to what the Republicans are feeling. I'm much more of a socialist than they are, and I believe, good, you know, let us keep the unemployment insurance as high as we possibly can and payouts so that people can live a decent life. I know a lot of people have been extremely challenged in this and really have a big problem.
Rosemary?
Well, the president has found money to add more than $1 million a mile to his stupid wall project because he wants the fence painted black. And he's given, of course, the contract to a guy he really likes, a buddy. So if there's money for that, why is there not money for people who have lost their jobs due to no fault of their own?
Yep.
So that's my first thought, is that his priorities are all out of whack, but we knew that. And the other one is, why does this man have the support of the working class? I don't get it. I never will. He's cutting taxes for the wealthy, not for them. He's cost them their jobs. He's cost them their markets and the trade war, and yet they support him. Amazing.
You know, when I keep coming back to my statement, which gets a certain amount of pro and con from listeners, that this is all about racism and Rosemary. And I think that when you take a look at some of the working class folks who have fallen for this incredibly stupid, you know, thing that those people are going to take your jobs, take your women, take your men, do all of this kind of stuff. That crap is exactly the kind of thing that makes foolish people fall.
Yeah.
That was a great response.
It's just wearying. I'm sorry.
It is wearying.
There's no sense in this at all. I just don't see the rationale.
Has there ever been sense in racism? I mean, has there ever been sense that somebody who has more, a little more something in their skin pigment, pigmentation, should be a second-class citizen? You just think about it for a minute. It is so stupid. It is so insulting. And yet there are too many Americans who fall for it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Bob Griffin.
Yeah, you know, I'm jumping on the comments from Alan and Rosemary. It's a continued vilification of people on welfare, as if an individual on welfare is a cheat, and this sort of old trope that, you know, they're taking money out of your pocket, and I'll note a couple degrees of hypocrisy. That standard is never applied to the corporate welfare that we provide. And secondly, we have a president who prides himself on not paying taxes, not paying his fair share, yet then wants to deny the most needy of us from help. And he acts as if this is his money. It's not. It's our money. It's the people's money. It's really cruel. It's really cruel. If you think the pressure people are under right now. The fact that they're not acting, Congress is not acting on an additional stimulus, and the president is talking about cutting back on benefits. Think about the angst that must be creating in millions of Americans.
Sure. I would like to talk about the hearing that took place tomorrow in just a moment, but because they were talking about how the stimulus money is going forward. But one of the things that strikes me about the $600 specifically, Terry, is it's not like these workers asked for it. This was the idea of the administration of getting out of an issue that I think they thought was going to be short term. It wasn't. And now they're making the people who are receiving the money out to be the bad people in this when they're just the ones receiving what the government said they were going to give them.
Well, that's a good point. And I think ultimately it'll be one of the reasons why they will find a way to extend the stimulus. I mean, sooner or later, it's going to occur to them that this problem is so much more complex. One of the problems we have is that even if an employer wants to start up their business again, they're confronted with a situation where they're not able to offer a safe work environment for their employees to return. Employees are questioning whether it is safe to return. It's not as simple as just the president waving his hand and saying, let's start the economy again. And the other complicated part of this has always been that he's offering no leadership at the top to give the employers and the employees confidence about coming back to work. And then you add into that the situation of how you're going to deal with children. You know, there's the daycare centers are still closed. The playgrounds are closed. The schools are closed. It's a very complex problem, and I think at the end of the day, they're going to discover that continuing to supplement people with this stimulus is going to be the easiest way to deal with it.
Wasn't the question always, Bob, from the very beginning, of whether it be the stimulus, whether it be the $600, whether it be even the corporate bailouts, of where in the name of God is this money coming from?
Well, yeah, and this is the advantage that the federal government has over the states.
Right.
The states, we have to have a balanced budget, which forces the governor and the legislature to make really hard decisions and frankly unpopular decisions. Congress has given itself no ceiling, so they are able to put on credit card and run up a deficit. And this administration has run up a huge deficit, which is not a problem for the Republican Party or Mitch McConnell until Biden wins. And then all of a sudden, the deficit's going to be the most important thing that Congress can do.
You bet.
But there's another part of this, Joe, that I'd just like to toss at people is that this is a situation. The federal government has got to provide aid back to the state and localities. This is where the service is being delivered. This is where the rubber really meets the road. And the fact that there's very little conversation or support from Kevin McCarthy or Mitch McConnell or the White House shows just a complete breakdown in their understanding of how services are provided.
Alan?
Joe, you know, we've had about 10 letters. I know you're going to be reading a lot of them, but they all say the same thing, which is, hey, you don't want people, you want people to come back to work? Pay them more.
Right. If there's jobs there. I mean, that's the other problem, right, Rosemary? No. I mean, you know, they're not even.
I mean, there are no jobs, and you've got this. I really feel for this senior class coming out of colleges right now. What are they going to do? They're loaded down with debt from student loans, and there's no jobs to go to at high wages or low. Something has to give, and I don't see the Republicans giving it right now.
Well, don't you think they'll have to, Rosemary? I mean, I just think it's a matter of they're getting their pound of flesh. But I think that there is such pressure on them that they will have to give something back to the states, including the Republican states, who have to pay their workers and their teachers and everybody else. I think they're going to do it, but I think they're going to insist that whatever it is, you can't sue them, you can't do this to them, that they're gonna negotiate.
Look, I don't think they've solved the initial problem, which is the health crisis. And I fully believe I'm waiting for the reports. Already we're seeing upticks in deaths in states that have gone back. And I think there's going to be more shutdowns. So they haven't even solved the basic problem of getting the economy running, much less encouraging people with money to go back to work.
I think it's as much a question of polling numbers, Alan, as it is about anything. And I think if the polls continue to turn against them, then they are going to have to act differently. And I would also contend that deep down inside, that this is Trump's insecurity within the fact that the governors, all of the governors have a higher approval rating except for one, and that's Kemp in Georgia, than the president does. And I do think this plays part of how he approaches the support.
Terry.
You know, people want I'm sorry, people want politicians to tell the truth. Apparently in Georgia now, they're not telling truth about how many people have the disease. Rosemary was very quick to point that out yesterday, and I really appreciate that, Rosemary, because you knew.
It's really interesting, and you notice in Florida, they've fired a woman. The circumstances are weird. I can't tell if she's at fault or he or the government is. But they fired her when she balked, she did it, but she first balked at the idea of taking down data on death. This is like raw information so that you don't listen to press releases. You can go right to the data records and see whether deaths and number of cases are going up and down. Florida doesn't want that available anymore. What, I mean, this is not good. If you're hiding stuff, it's not because it's really great news that you're afraid is going to get out there.
You know, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to follow up on something that Bob said a minute ago about it, how necessary it is the federal government supplement the state governments. And when we're talking about employment, they're directly connected. The state governments in many states and in many communities, including New York, are the biggest employers. So if you're talking about putting people back to work and you're not able to help the states hire those people back or to keep them from laying them off, you're talking about a huge hit in the unemployment
That's
numbers.
That's a good point.
Mm.
Sorry, Alan.
No, I just wanted to know. I know reading letters is yours, but every once in a while one gets me, which is racist. When Alan doesn't understand why somebody disagrees with him, he assumes it's because they're racist. Alan obviously does not interact with smart, caring Trump supporters. The panel will pretend reasonable Trump supporters don't exist because they're in a bubble. Like Alan sometimes mentions, Rosemary assumes sexism anytime someone challenges her. Well, I take it we're all in this letter from Frank.
All right. Bob.
I assume sexism when it's men who disagree with me.
I said, makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Bob, we got a minute. Go ahead.
And I just want to point out that, you know, since Reagan, we've been through devolution, we've been pushing federal responsibilities back to state and local government. That's been a hallmark of the GOP. And what they've done, though, is that they've taken away a lot of the safety nets that the country has enjoyed prior to that and pretty much put the country on very thin ice. And we're starting to see how bad those policies are right now. And then we can go to break.
All right. Let's take a break. We'll be back and continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo on the panel this morning. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's see. We'll go to a couple of these letters. Donna says, as in a small essential business that is unable to hire workers because of the unemployment benefit, I almost want to weep to hear it could be extended. Please consider the terrible impact of this policy in small business. Perhaps you can tell me how to explain to my team that they should work long hours and at risk while others stay at home. I'd like to hear supporters simply say we are okay with this inequality and the damage it will do to small business as a trade-off. Pay them more, as Alan said. How? That is such a heartless comment.
Who's the heartless? I don't get that. Why is it so heartless?
Pay them more, meaning they can't. I don't.
I think it's because the feeling is that the money isn't in the system right now, and they're struggling to survive. And I think this is the hard issue that we're coming up against. And maybe there is a middle ground. Maybe there is a policy that you could put in place to say that if we can A, prove that it's safe to go back to work, and B, people are offered the job back, that maybe there's a decrease, and maybe it isn't an all or nothing take on it. But in general, though, this is a sweeping position by the administration about cutting back on services to millions of Americans who are out of work right now.
We go to Molly, who said about unemployment payments. If unemployed workers are truly getting more money in this program than they did while working, has anyone thought that maybe those workers aren't earning enough to begin with? That from Molly in Lanesboro. She also says, hearing your voices is like seeing the gorgeous sunshine and growing green plants today. Thanks.
Oh, my goodness.
There you go, Rosemary.
That's a little much.
That was lovely. Well,
I think
nice.
What you just said is that we're fertilizer, but I'm not saying where that may have came from.
let me tell you about Molly. This station has no bigger supporter than Molly T. I can tell you that much. She has been wonderful to us. Wonderful.
We go to Martin, who says large corporations are likely lobbying lawmakers to vote against any pandemic unemployment insurance extension so they can force their low-wage workers back to work. Plus, they want it without providing safe working conditions and also want a liability waiver for those unsafe conditions. If the GOP controlled the House, you bet this would happen. Truly the party of the working man and woman. That from Marty.
Joe, if I can just chime in on that letter, and I think it probably ties into another story we're going to talk about. But the other issue here is that what the Republicans do seem to be willing to do is to send enormous amounts of stimulus directly to corporations without any real strings attached that require them to actually use that to hire their employees. So just giving the money to corporations is not really solving this employment dilemma either.
Right. And so let's talk about that. This was a hearing yesterday. We talk about the stimulus program and that it's struggling. There's a line in this article by David Leonhardt that I like, which is many companies, especially small businesses, have struggled to get loans. And in a high profile hearing yesterday, several senators criticized Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve Chair, and Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, for those problems. More quietly, though, there also seems to be a growing recognition in Congress among members of both parties that the execution of the stimulus program hasn't been the main problem. The design of the program has been. Much of the rest of the world, including Australia, Britain, Canada, France, Germany, and South Korea, has followed one strategy on coronavirus stimulus. Governments have temporarily paid the salaries of workers in order to prevent millions of layoffs. The U.S. has taken a different path. It created a complicated mix of different stimulus policies, including loans to businesses and checks for families. This approach doesn't appear to be working. The U.S. has had a sharper rise in unemployment than other countries. Many jobless Americans have also lost their health insurance in the midst of a pandemic. That idea that it's the design of the program that is the problem, I guess, is not a huge surprise, right, Rosemary?
Correct, yeah, yeah. The point was made earlier in this show that maybe it's not either one or the other. You do it or you don't. You come up with a new program, a new design is exactly what may be needed to balance conflicting demands of the system at an unprecedented time. Maybe that's what's needed. But that would require sort of bipartisan cooperation.
Bob, were you going or was it Terry?
It was me, Joe. I actually really like that approach and wish that Congress had taken that approach because it seems to be working in other countries, which, just because it works somewhere else in the world doesn't mean it wouldn't work here. And the approach of covering the payroll would have answered the question from the small business owner that wrote in earlier. And frankly, I think it would have been a fairer way to do it. The other point that I'll go back to Terry's comments. I think he's spot on with the lack of oversight going to businesses right now. And as you're looking at the changes that are being made in the inspector generals, it further weakens our ability to dig into and start to realize where our money is going. But I really do like that approach of paying people's typical payroll, and I think that would have helped small businesses.
So the stimulus bill that House Democrats passed last week includes a new paycheck subsidy program similar to those in the other countries. For businesses that have lost substantial revenue, it would cover as grants, not loans, as much as 80% of payroll costs, up to $60,000 per worker in annual salary. The policy would be expensive, yet still cheaper than the previous stimulus plans. The bill is only one sign of the idea's growing popularity. Yesterday, almost 100 House Democrats introduced a more ambitious version of the program, and senators across the ideological spectrum, from Josh Hawley, a Missouri Republican, on the right, to Doug Jones, an Alabama Democrat in the center, to Bernie Sanders, you know who he is, on the left, are pushing their own versions of the plan. So does it gain traction, Alan?
Well, it certainly sounds reasonable to me. It's going to take a lot of administration. And unfortunately, as we have all learned, if one side wants it, automatically the other side doesn't. What is it that the Republicans want here? Well, they want big business paid off one way or another. But I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you can satisfy both this very good idea of paying salaries and still giving the graft. Is that the right word?
Yes.
Graft or grift to the business guys. That's all it's ever been.
Terry?
It's exactly the right word, because what's going on here, Joe, is that on the Republican side, what they're listening to on a daily basis are the lobbyists that have all the power in this country right now because of our ridiculous campaign finance laws. The corporations are at their offices, on the phone with them, communicating with them any way they can every day, saying that, give us the money, give us the money. We know how best to use this money to keep our businesses and the economy going. The last thing they want is for this money to go directly to the employees.
Meanwhile, you have Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, who's continuing to speak skeptically about the need for any further stimulus. Regardless, any bill is likely to be more diffuse and complex than the approach of other countries, and any paycheck subsidy is likely to be less ambitious. That according to the article in the New York Times. So I guess this goes back, Rosemary, to what you were saying of earlier of this, of, you know, the appeal to the working class and just not getting it. But what even politically, I don't get it for someone like Mitch McConnell, who's got his own electoral worries.
I think, you know, Mitch McConnell has a very clear vision of what he wants and what he can get without running into trouble with Trump, having to deal with Trump. And I don't think it has anything to do with jobs or helping the working class. I think he's looking long-term at changing the look of America, and he's doing that with federal judicial spots. He's put up with an enormous amount of roiling of chaos and of corruption, and he's done it not for some short-term goal. I think he also just likes blocking Democrats. Mm. I think he's in it for the sheer political joy of power.
We got this.
I wish we could understand what his vision is, though. Rosemary, do you have a sense of what his vision of America is?
Because he wants a conservative America. I think it's racial. It's keeping corporations and business on top. He and his wife have enriched themselves by following this policy. He has no interest in compromise or what's really. Look at what happened. If Ruth Bader Ginsburg were to die tomorrow, I'm crossing myself as I say that because it's a hypothetical. Do you think he would have any scruples about putting in somebody, even though there's less than a few months before an election? Do you think that there's principles there? It's
no,
and it's for more than just, you know, a vision of the economy. It's long term. It's what we saw in the Republican donors have been giving this, working for years towards slowly stopping women's reproductive rights in the state level rather than at the federal level, at changing the judiciary, at ending voting patterns that could help Democrats. It's all being protected. I think one of the things he wants right now is the end of voting by mail, which would help Democrats in their view.
Justin writes, go ahead.
I'm sorry, no, Joe, I was just waiting for the lightning to hit Rosemary. she said she was crossing herself. That's a really interesting point in the hypocrisy of voting by mail, particularly where Trump has voted by mail so many times. I just shake my head. Mitch McConnell sort of become my poster child for term limits, which I've never really supported because I always felt that term limits are determined at the ballot box. But he's been in, let's call it what it is. He's been in D.C. so long, he's forgotten what's important.
Well, they aren't determined by at the ballot box. Obviously, they're determined on K Street, as has been said by Senator Gibson. That's where it's determined. If it was a fair fight, okay, but it isn't. It's all about money.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we have a lot of letters. We'll get to those and talk more about these issues and much more. We welcome your input, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Sid and Marty Croft Puppet Hour. very nice to have you with us. Delight to have you on the program. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, letters. We have lots of them. Let's go. Ed says, dear panel, do people who are struggling and afraid become vulnerable to their own worst instincts? I think we probably all do. I would suggest to you that Trump's followers, the kind who wear the hats and show up at the rallies, are undereducated and afraid and struggling to keep their place in the lower echelons of the middle class. I think this is looking to answer your question, Rosemary. Trump, like so many leaders before him, deflects criticism by this insecure middle class away from himself and Republican Party policy, where it rightfully belongs, and onto minorities in the lower classes. These people in the insecure middle class need our help, not our condemnation. That from Ed. We go then to John.
Can I just jump in for a second?
Of course,
Joe? I mean, but it's as much about empowerment, though, because if you look at a lot of what's occurring, particularly at a MAGA rally, it's screwing with others. This idea of poking at what they think are elitists, whether it's East Coasters, West Coasters, whether it's educated, whether it's liberal, it's this really, really mean streak in America about a willingness to let things go to crap, and they recognize Trump's flaws, but because he messes with people that they think should be messed with, it becomes a game.
That's well put. Yep.
Sally writes, just when you, oh, actually, let me go, Justin is where I'm going. Within the past 24 hours, I've had two friends admit that they're reluctant to go back to work because they are making more on unemployment. I understand that on the individual level, it's hard to justify working for less than what you're receiving to stay home and not work, but it is a risk because the assumption is that when the additional unemployment benefit dries up, those jobs will still be available.
It's not only economic, it's the fact that if you go back to work, the potential for illness is much greater. I mean, I don't think we can ignore that, right?
No, not at all. Continuing with the letter, I think that this has becomes an issue of personal ethics. There is a big difference between those of us whose jobs have been terminated and those of us who could go back to work and are choosing not to, and to not return to work or look for a new job is short-sighted in two ways. It overlooks the challenge of finding a job when suddenly millions of people are also looking for one, and ignores that if we want to avoid an even greater disruption in the economy, we need to work when we can, to produce goods and services to contribute to the GDP. That from Justin. Sam.
It's a tough one. It's really a tough one, because think of all of us who are sheltered in our homes, who are not touching our magazines because somebody else may have touched the magazines, don't open the mail for days. I think that what we're ignoring, in addition to this impetus for going back to work, is the idea that people are protecting themselves.
Right. Yeah. And
isn't it just like baseball players who sign gigantic contracts that seem way out of line with exactly the work they're doing, but they have a limited time span? I mean, here, if you have guaranteed unemployment, which is bigger than your regular paycheck, wouldn't you want to just get it so you could bank some of it or pay down bills or get ready, seeing that trouble is not going to just magically disappear despite what the president says in a few weeks? Doesn't that make actual economic sense to do it? I don't think it's greed or laziness.
Yeah, well, that goes back to... Go ahead, Bob.
It does until you realize that the benefit only goes until the end of July. And then if you give up your job... I don't know what happens after folks after July. The other, if I could just go back to a point that you made earlier, Rosemary, I think class plays a big role in this. If you start to think about, the folks that have to go back to work, a lot of white collar jobs you can do remotely. You can do online. You can't build a house remotely. Yeah. Okay. You can't check out somebody in a supermarket line remotely. And really what it becomes is that the folks that are in those types of jobs are disaffected more so than I think a lot of the white collar employees are.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
It doesn't help solve the problem, but I think it needs to be recognized.
We're going to go to, let's see, another letter here from Dean, who says, I run a small business affected by the lack of travel. Although I'd love to have a grant for my business to pay its bills, if people don't have money to buy my service, I won't have any paying customers. I submit that money should flow from the bottom up rather than the top down. Give people money and they will spend it on things they need. Businesses will be just fine as long as they have customers. I hope that's true. Catherine writes, please address the problem many workers have to put two part-time jobs, that they have to work two part-time jobs because that way employers don't have to give benefits. They're getting killed with health care insurance costs, lack of benefits, job security and education benefit, retirement, and a steady schedule. Oh, yes, daycare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we could add living wage onto that issue as well. And as I've said several times over the past couple of months, that you start to see this confluence of what I think are really bad public policy decisions, which on their own may look bad, but when you start to combine them together, it becomes a much larger problem, and that's what we're seeing right here.
Sam says, there aren't any smart Trump supporters. They're all racist, period, by being supporters to the most racist administration we have had in our country for centuries. I just ordered personal bumper stickers and the scourge, dump Trump. The entire Republican Party has become enmeshed in this racist culture of this administration.
Hank, you know, that sounds extreme, but I actually think she has a good point. You can say, I'm not a racist, I'm loving, caring, a good person. But if you can see your way to still supporting Trump in light of all that he's done and stood for, you are at the very least supporting racism. And I think she has a point.
Yeah, but the hard part, though, Rosemary, is that how do we come back together again? If we create this as a zero-sum conversation where those people are all wrong, we're right, and those other people are saying we're right, you're all wrong, how do we come back together as a nation? And I'm really reluctant to support a position that says that everybody is anything, because there's nothing that is so clear. Everything is sort of more nuanced and shades of gray than that. So I'm not comfortable with saying that everybody that supports Trump is an idiot.
The reason we have not been able to come together for 300 years, which is why racism is still a problem. And I don't think that saying, okay, I'm not going to call him a racist, even though I think it, I don't think that helps me to come together with anybody.
This is to Alan's earlier point. Paul says, we want to incentivize persons to stay home until it's safe to return to work. So temporarily, it's fine to pay them a few dollars more than they might make in a low-paying, unsafe workplace. Let's see. Marty says, large corporations are likely lobbying lawmakers to vote against any pandemic employment insurance extension so they can force their low-wage workers back to work. Plus, they want it without providing safe working conditions and also want a liability waiver for those unsafe conditions. If the GOP controlled the House, you bet this would happen. Truly the party. Oh, did I already read that? I think I read that.
No, but it's worth reading again. It's
okay.
A great letter.
All right. Hank says, as a self-employed sole proprietor, I applied for the PUA program in late March and haven't received a cent yet. I think this is in response to the governor saying that they were caught up. Is that what I'm getting in this, I think?
Yeah.
I was on the phone with Cahill's office yesterday and was told that I am not alone. So there's a report.
Actually, I was talking about what Cuomo and Melissa DeRosa and others had said, that they are now caught up on those people who couldn't get an answer.
Sally said, just when you think that Trump can get more ridiculous, petty, and revolting, he's not only takes himself, but thereby encourages others to take a potentially dangerous and unproven drug, but he also refuses to hang President Obama's portrait. There is something so insidious about his reaction to the former president that you have to ask yourself how deep his mental illness goes, how utterly pathetic and embarrassing our current president is.
I just want to mention that he's the president of the United States. He got there. How? He got there by doing exactly this kind of garbage. And he is not going to change his modus operandi one bit, because he thinks if he won it one time doing that, he'll do it again. The letter writer is exactly right. Not putting that portrait up is just unbelievable. But it is symbolic of what this guy is all about and his hatred and the rest.
Rosemary?
I can't recall how many times in this past weekend trying to teach my 7-year-old granddaughter to be gracious and charming and to accept defeat in a gracious way, that why am I teaching her this? The president's mother didn't teach him that, and he's done pretty well.
Because it's the right thing to do.
Correct.
Right.
Well, unless you're leaving billions of dollars to your granddaughter, though, I mean, we're
and then, you know, game done, yeah. Game over.
Yeah.
Because we have just about 2 minutes, and I don't really want to spend much more time on it than that, but the hanging of the portrait, I agree. I mean, it is ridiculous and it's stupid, and I don't see any reason, and it's another norm that's tossed out the window. But if you're President Obama, do you want to have your portrait going up right now and having to, the awkwardness of having to go to the White House? I don't know. It seems to me like whoever is planning that, it was just like, maybe we'll wait for a couple months.
Well, the difference is Obama would do it and do it graciously and charmingly.
Well, he would, but it wouldn't. I mean, it's just, it puts more spectacle to it because you know the person who's on the other, you know, on the other side is going to be a jerk about it.
Well, Joe, you're right. You're absolutely right. If you were Trump, you would not want it for all of the reasons you mentioned. But it still shows him to be a classless.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely.
Terrible guy.
Yeah, it does. But we know that. You know, we know that, and I just don't know, like, why you sort of walk in and say, okay, oh, maybe this won't be a fight. Well, of course it's going to be a fight. It's going to be stupid, and go ahead.
But Joe, it's the people's house. It's not Trump's house. It's the people's house, and every tour that goes through there should see the picture of President Obama. And having spent time in both the White House and Pentagon, when you see the portraits of all of the leaders that came before you, it gives you a sense of how important it is in the historical context of the nation. And denying that in our house invalidates those elections, and that's not fair.
I agree with you. I don't disagree with you. I wonder, though, it seems like a fight you know that you're going to have, right? I mean, you just know that you're going to, anything that has to do with Obama is going to cause a fight with this White House.
Well, it's distracting, and most of all, because we've seen it again and again and again, it goes directly to the base. This is how you get them going.
Well, it's not even effective, is it? I mean, I looked up Obama's portrait when I read about this. He's calling more attention to the portrait, not diminishing Obama, diminishing Obama in the least, I think.
No, he is with his base, Rosemary. I suspect he is. He knows that if he's basically calling out Obama one way or the other, or impugning him, he wasn't born here, the rest of it, that he got elected president that way, and he's going to do it again.
Meanwhile, it's a beautiful portrait. It really is very cool.
He's a beautiful man. I mean, he was wonderful. Is wonderful.
True.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to talk about. We'll do so in just a moment. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Shartok, Terry Gibson, Robert Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo. We do welcome your letters as well, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Okay, so let us talk for a moment about... I want to go to the story that Rosemary referenced earlier in our conversation about the border wall, $1.3 billion. The preferred construction firm of Donald Trump, is how the Washington Post puts it, has landed the $1.3 billion border wall contract, the biggest so far. They're from North Dakota. Construction firm that has received backing from President Trump has now secured the largest border wall contract ever awarded. They, in return for that $1.3 billion, will build 42 miles of black painted fencing through the rugged mountains of southern Arizona. The company that won the contract, Fisher Sand and Gravel, has been repeatedly lauded by the president in White House meetings with border officials and military commanders, the result of a long and personalized marketing pitch to Trump and ardent supporters of his barrier project. after its initial bids for border contracts were passed over. The company and its CEO, Tommy Fischer, cut a direct path to the president by praising him on cable news, donating to his Republican allies, and cultivating ties to former Trump advisors Steve Bannon, GOP Senate candidate Kris Kobach, and other conservative figures in Trump's orbit. Fischer's first and only other major border contract for $400 million is under review by the Defense Department Inspector General after Democratic lawmakers raised concerns about improper White House influence on the procurement process. The Inspector General's office confirmed Tuesday that the audit is ongoing. Rosemary.
Okay, it's almost classic cronyism and corruption, and I want to see a lot more reporting on this. Theirs was the lowest bid. So, I mean, I'd be beating a track to the other competitors for this bid to see how did that come about, why is it lower, and did it come from inside information from the White House. It also shows how incredibly corruptible Trump is. They did exactly the right things in order to get that contract. They kissed up to him. They went on television and praised him. All the things that should have nothing to do with the project. Their work appears to be inferior. As you know, it's already under they're very inexperienced, even if it proves that they did nothing wrong in getting the contract. Why do we not put more emphasis on competence in the largest federal government infrastructure project of all times? You would think that you would want kind of the best to do this. And then, of course, at the base of it, the third level of this is the need for the wall at all, which remains very much in doubt in my mind and those of many others of the non-Trump persuasion.
Terry?
Well, it's just another example of how money plays such a powerful role in who wins and who loses in our federal government right now. I mean, this company is playing the game. They have hired a very powerful lobbying company. They have reached out and built a network of people that have influence. You can trace the money right back to the senators and the House of Representatives members in this state of North Dakota. Everybody in that state has benefited financially if you're an elected official. And Trump himself is benefiting. It's the way the game is played, and it's why our campaign finance laws have just got to change.
Bob.
First, before I make my comment, Joe, I need to say that the music that's being played today makes me feel like I'm in a really bad 1970s made-for-TV movie about teen love. So I'm struggling with the music today.
It's an after
well, you are.
Yeah, it's an after-school special.
Yeah,
it's a special edition. By the way, I just want to read this letter real quick because we're on this. But good sunny spring morning panel, says Jade. To be listening to the radio these days and hear one man refer to another man as a beautiful man is gentle music to my ears.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, Bob. Go ahead.
You know, let me jump on some of the comments that both Rosemary and Terry have made and add to it. In part, I think this is the beginning of what's going to be an accelerated rape of our treasury, that as the election grows near, we're going to see more and more of these. And this is where this, the whole issue of the inspector generals and Trump firing inspector generals who are actually doing their job becomes really insidious. Because these are the people that are supposed to be investigating this action. And when they're looking over their shoulders saying, well, if I actually investigate this, I'm going to be fired. Guess what's not going to happen? We're not going to have the oversight that we need. And this is where all of these pieces start to fit in. And it shows you that this is a purposeful effort by this administration to fleece the taxpayers. And basically, this is swamp politics at its worst.
I predict.
Swamp politics at its most efficient. And follow that up with the Justice Department, who acts, he doesn't even have to pardon people now. They just drop the charges and go after the judges that try to keep the system honest. It's crazed.
I predict.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I want Alan's prediction, yes.
Okay, I predict that when and if the Democrats win, let's say Biden wins, that the first guys will be calling for reinforcing the Inspector General laws will be the Republicans in the United States Senate. That's my prediction. I'm sticking with it.
Makes sense. Anybody else?
Well, I hope the next president does the same thing Trump did and dump all the Trump appointees, because they're, as Bob noted, they're a suspect right there. They were put in with a view towards ending investigations, not continuing them.
So it's a difficult road.
It would be justified to just get rid of them wholesale.
It's a difficult road, because once you get that tit-for-tat kind of thing going, Rosemary, you create, you know, a system that is even more at odds. I get what you're saying, and I understand it, but I do think it's dangerous.
Yeah, I understand your point, too, but wouldn't you, aren't you immediately suspect of the guy who's going to replace Linux in the State Department?
Absolutely.
Aren't you suspect of the replacement that he got rid of for his impeachment?
Yeah.
These are the ones who actually followed the rule. They were at, one of them was actually a Trump appointee, and he still passed on the complaint to Congress because that's the law.
Bob?
Yeah, and that's where I think a review isn't about partisan politics. It's about capacity, and it's about the ability. And if you meet the requirements for the job, and you're doing your job, you should have that job. So the idea of a whole-scale sort of wipeout of the bureaucracy, which brings us way back to the Jacksonian days, I agree with Alan, it's dangerous. At the same time, I do think we need to go in and look and make sure that people who are holding high federal positions are qualified to do it. The other point, and what really kind of breaks my heart, Joe, is that we're hearing from these small business owners who are absolutely desperate to try to get back to work. And I think about $32 million a mile, $32 million a mile for a fence. And this is where I go, where are our priorities as a people? And frankly, who the heck is watching over this down in D.C.? Where are our elected officials? I mean, $32 million a mile. Think what we could do to help our small businesses with that money.
We go to, I just want to take a couple of letters here. Savannah says, should Trump be voted out, will the contracts for the building of the wall be null and void?
No, it
doesn't. And frankly, what they would do is you could go in and make sure that the procurement process was fair and followed the law, and that's it. And otherwise, what will happen is that the company will go to court, and more often than not, the corporations or businesses win in that situation.
We got a letter.
You don't have to build the wall, though. You could pay them off and just say we're not doing the project.
Yeah, but you'd still have there'd still be penalty clauses within the contract, and the taxpayers would be still putting out a hefty sum of money. But you're correct.
Susan writes to us and says, I think that if unemployment benefits are higher than salaries, it's because of benefits which are coming from the first $3 trillion bailout, which will not be so for very long. In the past, I remember getting the benefits. It was always a percentage of my salary, never more than my salary. Luke says, in regards to returning to work, OSHA requires an employer to provide PPE, personal protective equipment. Lots of employers are providing disposable masks of unknown effectiveness, and employees are bringing their own. OSHA has criteria for PPE, requiring employers to assure the adequacy of the equipment. How long before the first lawsuits when someone gets sick at work?
One of the things that they're trying to do, the Republicans are trying to do, is say no lawsuits as part of any deal that gets made from now on.
We do have a letter here from George, who says the Obama portrait introduces a new manner of representation to the White House. It uses the European tradition of portraits of kings and adapts it to African visions of strength of the kingdom, testing on the largesse and authority of the chief, the floral motif, the seated throne-like attitude. Trump doesn't want this kind of competition visible where he lives and acts. Undoubtedly racist attitude, but the guy is a propaganda genius, so incidentally is the artist of the portrait.
I sure hate that word genius when it comes to Trump. No, I think he's diabolically clever. I think he got himself elected president, or using what he's done. But I hate to call him a genius, because anybody who has done what he's done to this country doesn't deserve that appellation.
Let's go to the question of, we continue on the Inspector General and what we're finding out about his firing over allegedly an investigation into the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo declined an interview request for the State Department Inspector General's inquiry into whether the Trump administration acted illegally in declaring an emergency, quote unquote, to bypass a congressional freeze on arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, according to three people with knowledge on his actions. Mr. Pompeo chose instead to answer questions, written questions, from investigators working for the Inspector General, Steve Linnick, who was fired by the president on Friday. That indicates that the Secretary of State was aware of Mr. Linnick's investigation and the specific lines of questioning about Mr. Pompeo's decision last year to resume the sales of bombs and other weapons, which has been stalled since 2017. Saudi Arabia has led Persian Gulf nations in an air war in Yemen that has resulted in large numbers of civilian deaths. It's still not clear why Mr. Linnick was dismissed. He was also pursuing inquiries into whether Mr. Pompeo was improperly asking a State Department employee to run errands for him and his wife. Bob Griffin.
There is so much here, Joe. And let me sort of frame for everybody. I spent almost 10 years in the federal government, and I had the pleasure of working for Secretary Napolitano, Secretary Johnson, and Secretary Kelly, who came in as President Trump's first DHS secretary. None of those three would ever personally or allow their staff to ignore a request from the Attorney General. And this idea that you can be selective about who you talk to and basically block the law of the land, which is what Pompeo is doing, is so egregious to me that, I mean, more than a lot of the things we've talked about today, this is what really scares me the most, is this idea that we can now be selective about which laws we're going to follow and which laws we're not. Congress, and particularly the Senate, and I will name Grassley among others, who at one point in time was a huge champion of the whistleblower protections and the IG process, they should be ashamed of themselves right now. But what they're doing creates this long-term malaise, and it's something that I never could have imagined in my time in the federal government.
So it's hard to come up with these, but it isn't hard to come up with these, which is, here's the Trump quote of the day yesterday on this matter of the investigation, as far as the second part of the investigation, what we think that they were looking into, the fact of the use of Pompeo's staff. President Trump said, quote, look, he's a high quality person, Mike. He's a very high quality. He's a very brilliant guy. Trump was speaking to reporters in the White House after he was asked whether he was concerned that Pompeo might have requested the watchdog's ouster to halt the investigations. And now I have you telling me about dog walking, washing dishes, and you know what? I'd rather have him on the phone with some world leader than have him wash dishes, because maybe his wife isn't there or his kids aren't there, you know, Trump said.
No,
Rosemary, you want to go first on that one?
It's part of Trump's whole dismantling. The administration has dismantled congressional oversight. He has used the Department of Justice. He's changed the judiciary. He's switching it over so that his egregious acts are getting support from the courts. And now the Inspector General. And he's also fighting congressional subpoenas. It's very systematic. And while we're sputtering at each of these small things, look at the big picture, which, again, I think Mitch McConnell has something to do with this, too. They are building a king. They're building royalty instead of an executive branch.
And, Rosemary, what people need to remember is that there are laws against public officials using their positions for personal gain.
And this is personal gain. You know something? If Pompeo needs somebody to walk his dog, then go pay your own damn money to find a dog walker. My tax dollars shouldn't be walking Pompeo's dog or picking up his underwear or doing his dry cleaning. And again, I go back to the small business owners who are suffering right now. Every dollar that goes into this crap from Pompeo is a dollar that we're not able to put into our economy to get this country back on its feet. It's criminal. It's criminal. And the fact that they're blocking the investigation makes this even worse.
Alan.
Bob, you're a beautiful man. I just want to say that again.
Yeah, I second that.
I'm sorry. I'm thinking about Keish Thorane right now, trying to keep my blood pressure down.
Real beautiful man, no need, Keish. Go ahead.
You know, there are so many things that Pompeo is doing that are going to affect and even end up killing more people. That, you know, I have a feeling that Trump loves this dog walking thing. Because, Bob, you know, there are a lot of bosses who have had people walk the dog. You know, people were always offering to walk Murray, and I never wanted it because I always saw around the corner that, you know, somebody would say that's inappropriate. But I think, you know, his intuition on what turns that base on is still good. And, you know, I think that you're going to go after Pompeo, go after him for the very phone calls that he's making, that Trump is alluding to, which have so much negativity to them with the Saudis and the Russians and the rest. I think we're falling for it.
You know, yeah. Joe, this story just shows once again that the Republican Party has just become a literal doormat for the Trump administration. I mean, the Republican Senate actually put a check on the president initially by voting for this congressional freeze for the Saudi Arabian arms sales. It was one of the few times we actually had this bipartisan check put on the president. But now he has just completely walked over them and said, I'm still going to do whatever I want. And they're just silence. Nothing comes from them. Not one single Republican senator has stood up and said, this is wrong. We need to look into this. They just continually lay down and say, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Alan?
No, I'll pass.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, okay.
No.
All right. We have about 5 minutes. Let me go to, before another break, let me go to some letters if we can.
Oh, I do want to come back, if I can, Joe, for a moment, to the concept of, you know, limiting terms, term limits for individuals. We've gotten some mail on this kind of thing. I did say before, as long as we have the kind of corrupted system where money talks and all others walk. But I tell you, once these guys get into office, there is no getting anybody out. Very seldom. You may have a shift in a demographic, hence AOC wins in her district, and she works hard to do that. I think New York City, by the way, has term limits, and they're extremely effective, except when they're for Mike Bloomberg, who, as you know, bought that third term, which he wasn't entitled to. It is, to me, a panacea. I happen to believe in them. I've always believed in them. My political science friends and colleagues have always said, no, you don't know what you're talking about. Elections are the term limit, but they're not.
That's true. You know, the numbers do continually show that the people do not come out and vote in the numbers that allow us to have that type of rotation we ought to have of constant fresh blood coming into our democracy. And so the voting excuse just isn't working. We really do need term limits.
Bob?
I was going to agree with Alan, and it goes back to something Terry said a couple times today that I got to pick up on, and it's the amount of money that goes into these elections, which is just frankly obscene, and it shows that we've got an awful lot of work to do as a society to put our republic back on track.
Rosemary?
Money drives us all.
Well, I wish that term limits were the answer. I think that if they were, we would already see an improvement in government. Wasn't it term limits that allowed the Tea Party to get in with dozens of open seats and challenges to incumbents? I have been on this panel, and I think I'll continue to be a proponent of experience and integrity. Nancy Pelosi would be out if we had term limits.
And Mitch, yes, that's true, and Mitch McConnell would be too.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, but just but Joe, you know, when you look at the...
There you go. That's the yin and yang of it.
All right, Bob, and then Terry, go ahead.
Real quick, I gotta give a compliment to Nancy Pelosi for the best burn of the week yesterday.
Oh yeah.
On Trump.
And also to the Washington Post, which came back and said, no, actually, she's 70 pounds off. He's overweight, but he's not morbidly obese.
If you believe the numbers coming out of his doctor.
A little Trumpian, deserved Trumpian exaggeration.
Mm-hmm. It was funny, though.
I was just going to say that to Rosemary's point. We do have many good, experienced elected officials in both the Senate and the House of Representatives. Nancy Pelosi mm-hmm. is certainly one of them, and mm-hmm. I'm grateful for their presence. But to think that all of our elected representatives are experienced and qualified to be there, I think is a real stretch. There are many people in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate that really shouldn't be given the responsibility to run a Pizza Hut, much less be in a federal elected position. And they get there because of these ridiculous campaign finance laws and the lack of any ability to remove them because people don't vote. You'd be really surprised at how few people vote in some of these congressional districts. Even in New York State, there is such a low turnout of people that come.
Yeah, Terry, I think you hit on what really could bring about reform, and that's campaign finance reform, which is now never going to happen until after the Supreme Court ruled on Citizens United 10 years ago. That seems to me educated electorate and fair campaign finance laws. Then you'd have the mix of experience and newcomer. I want AOC and Nancy Pelosi. And if you just say, we'll put in term limits, you lose one or the other. Do you see my point?
Yes.
I don't think it's quite that simple, but I do see the point you're trying to make.
Yeah, no, it isn't simple. I agree with you on that.
Paul writes and says, McConnell and Graham are talking about subpoenas for Obama officials for phony Obamagate investigation. Can those officials just ignore subpoenas like Trump's guys did? And then, go ahead. Anyone? No?
It's a really good question, and this gets to the danger that we were trying to highlight a little bit earlier, that when we allow our politicians and our public servants to start to be selective about which laws they follow, this becomes the slippery slope that we're on. I personally think it would be incredibly dangerous to start to allow investigation or review of Obama, because when the Senate's going to flip, it's going to be turned around. And that's that tit for tat that we were also talking about earlier.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with the conversation and wrap up with our last go around. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo making up the panel this morning. And we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to, hey, what do you think about talcum powder?
Oh, wow. That's a great story.
Johnson & Johnson. This is an interesting story for a couple of reasons, one of which is that I just, for as long as I can remember, they have been trying to get talcum powder off the market. And now, finally, Johnson & Johnson announced that they are going to end talc-based baby powder sales in North America. The company has faced thousands of lawsuits from cancer patients who claim that its talc was contaminated with asbestos, a known carcinogen, and the company knew of the risks. They are now discontinuing North American sales of its baby powder, a product that once defined the company's wholesome image and that it has defended for decades, even as it faced thousands of lawsuits filed by patients who say that it caused cancer. The decision to wind down sales of the product is a huge concession for Johnson & Johnson, which has for more than a century promoted the powder as pure and gentle enough for a baby's tushy. I added the tushy part, but go ahead.
This is a very dangerous subject.
Why?
Well, I really can't say. I really can't say.
Okay. Well, that doesn't help
you,
me.
You can just. I once went out with a girl, and she just used a lot of talcum powder all over her whole body. I'm not talking about any particular parts. And I can only say,
Jet,
that.
Please.
We all did. And talcum powder, along with vanilla, is one of the smells that turn men on. Every woman knows this.
Yeah, but not patchouli.
No, not patchouli. I know. I can't wear any perfume around you. Yes, I know.
But you know something? We're laughing, but, you know, to me, it's such a strong scent. The idea of you know, when my boys, who are now older, were babies, that coming out of a bath and they were clean and they're snuggly clothes and smelling like the powder. Boy, I'll tell you what, that really resonates with me. So I'm very sad. Maybe we can replicate the smell.
Cornstarch.
In a safer
Cornstarch.
Way.
Cornstarch.
Yeah. Here's the thing. You can't really blame the company for having this product originally, because no one knew that talc had asbestos in it for a long time. But then they did find out, and that's when the liability begins. They didn't
Absolutely.
Do anything about it. It's the same. Johnson & Johnson's implicated in the opioid fraud as well. And the scary thing to me is that they are discontinuing sales of talc in the U.S., but they're going to continue selling it elsewhere. So it's okay if other babies in other countries get cancer from this?
Yeah.
How is that right? So responsible corporate behavior. You know, we don't expect that you're going to know years ahead of everybody else that something is environmentally or public health dangerous. But when you do find out, then you got to act. This is just like cigarette companies. It's tobacco companies and alcohol companies.
Yeah. Bob, are you going to say anything else?
No, I think it's really well said, and I think it raises questions not just about Johnson & Johnson, but if you think about our policies on cigarettes and
alcohol.
Lots of products we
discover later they have dangers. Laudanum. You used to be able to buy laudanum in this country, and cocaine, coked up products to relax women. It was widespread. And then when you find out that it's a danger, you stop it. And that's what I think. I don't have the full story. When did they know it, and what's the lapse between then and when they pulled the product? And the fact that they continue to sell it overseas makes me really upset. It's like, remember Nestle, when they found out that Nestle formula for babies was stopping breastfeeding in places in the developing world where breastfeeding would have made more sense, been healthier for people, and they continued selling. That's irresponsible, horrible corporate behavior.
Joe, where I think Elizabeth Warren was really right, that we need to strengthen our consumer protections just for this reason. This idea that corporations, because they're corporations, are going to be morally upstanding citizens, because since they're considered individuals, is faulty. And it's not just Nestle. You can go back to Ford and the Pinto, and you can go back to case after case after case. And I'm not trying to say that corporations are all villains, but at the same time, there needs to be a check and balance. And what we've done is that we've taken the check and balance of both regulation and the bureaucracy out of the equation.
Does anybody know whether Coca-Cola ever had Coke in it?
Long time ago.
And
it wasn't used as a beverage. It was used as a I want to say
right?
What?
As a medicine.
Yeah,
correct?
As a medicine. I think it was some sort of cold, a cold and flu kind of thing, was my understanding.
Well, I hate to do this, Rosemary, but when I was at Camp Bronx House and you had a cough, they gave you Coke syrup. I remember Coke syrup, but I'm sure
syrup. I just have finished the novel, Charles Frazier's novel about Verena Davis, the first lady of the Confederacy. It's an interesting book. But throughout it all, from the time she was a young girl, she had problems with her nerves, and then childbirth, and then all the things that could happen to a woman in the 1800s. And every time, from mental illness to childbirth pain, the prescription was for laudanum. She just drank it in her wine every night.
By the way, I don't think
Joe,
there was Coke. I don't think there was Coke in at Camp Bronx House. period.
Yeah, probably not.
I want to go on the record there. Hello.
Terry.
I just wanted to point out that Johnson & Johnson has a long history with controversies over the products. If you remember way back in the 80s with the Tylenol murders, where they had people tampering with their Tylenol product, they actually came out of that with a lot of positive compliments. They were, for a longest time, were considered a leader in how to manage a public relations crisis as a result of how they dealt with the Tylenol situation. But since then, they haven't seemed to have done so well. And one of the questions I have about this particular issue with talcum powder is it a coincidence that they have finally decided to drop this in the United States at the same time that they're expected to be one of the real players in providing a vaccine for the coronavirus? I just feel like there's some relationship to those two. They're trying to push one thing aside so they can begin.
Well, I think what it is more like when they were involved in opioid and all these lawsuits start piling up, as they are with the asbestos and talcum powder. And so they say, okay, we're going to stop. It helps you, I think, in court when you're fighting against that sort of liability.
All I know is that when I watch my programs on the television, Rosemary, you know what they are.
I watch them too.
I can only say that they're the lawyers. There are always some advertising about talcum powder, so
right.
that had to be part of the figuring.
You know, Terry, I'm just going to mention it because I'm sure we'll get letters on it. But not only Tylenol, which is produced by McNeil, which is a brand of Johnson & Johnson, but also Johnson & Johnson and the toxic shock syndrome over tampons, also in the 80s, was a huge crisis as well. So, all right, let's anything on it? Go ahead.
They never found the Tylenol guy, right? Whoever did that.
I think they did finally have a suspect towards the end there. I believe, if I remember correctly.
I'm looking it up right now, but I.
I have a way of asking these questions, you know.
Yes. Go ahead, Bob.
And connect this. It's more of a question and somewhat of a crazy conspiracy theory. Is, you know, we talked earlier about talking about trying to insulate corporations from lawsuits. And my question is that, and something I think you need to watch is how far does that go back? And would Johnson & Johnson be now protected because of that law? And I think that's something that we have to watch. And Rosemary spent almost three decades down in Virginia. I could tell you, it's because it helped with the vapors.
Yes, exactly. Well, I hate to say it's all sexism, but yes, that's it. Men, male doctors, which they all were at the time, just thought women had this weak constitution, and you just had to calm them down. So yeah,
no. No suspect was ever charged or convicted of the poisonings and the Tylenol murders. Oh. New York City resident James William Lewis was convicted of extortion for sending a letter to Johnson & Johnson that took credit for the deaths and demanded $1 million to stop them, but evidence tying him to the actual poisoning never emerged. Seven
Good call,
deaths.
Alan.
Yes. Good memory, Alan. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's go to what do we have? We got about 5 minutes. Let me see what we got on the letter front here. We go to John, who says, panel, cornstarch is not a suitable substitute for baby powder because it can feed bacteria that live in moist places. I'll let your mind go there. Okay. And Coke, Pepsi, and Dr. Pepper were all created by pharmacists. Dr. Pepper is the oldest. Coke had cocaine. Yes. So...
I knew if I asked the question, we would get a lot of people, much more people, many more people concerned about that than, you know, Trump in the White House.
Let's see. Carol writes, I can remember exactly where I was when I heard in 1976 or 77 that there was asbestos in bath powder. I immediately stopped using it. Then never heard another word about it, a rare benefit of getting older. When I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer 20 years ago, they asked me about talc use. They've known for decades that from Ellen. And let's see. Thank you, Bob, says Elizabeth. I woke up feeling like Bob. I am grateful for his honesty today. Our elected officials need to start Our elected officials need to start expressing outrage and perhaps resistance. We just keep wading deeper and deeper into the sinkhole. I don't know what the answer is, but I voted for people smarter than me, and I would like to see some of them actually rise up.
Thank you, and we can split a piece of quiche later to try to get over this.
Let's see. We go to Laurel, who says, in addition to the ingredients in powder, the danger inherent to body powder is the way they are dispensed and applied. The typical container makes the powder airborne and easy to inhale. I switched to storing cornstarch in a dish with the lid and applying by hand. As a result, the wheeze in my lungs soon appeared. All right. Let's see. Is that it? I think that may be it.
I have one more question. I wonder where the girl who I was referring to before with the talcum powder is these days.
You know, suddenly all that, the intro music you've been using today seems more appropriate.
Yes, I think you're right, Terry. You're right. It does. It brings it all home, doesn't it?
Yes.
Well, my thanks to the panel this morning. Thank you for everyone for writing. Thank you for being a part, and very nice to have you with us. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo, thank you all.
Thank you, Joe.
All right.
Thank you.